in the studio to discuss permaculture. I've got Finn Mackesy. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are we doing?
Yeah, good.
We're here to talk about permaculture, and we're going through the permaculture domains. And just a brief background, these domains, who was behind this concept?
So this is the work of David Holmgren, one of the co-originators of the permaculture concept. So yeah. Him and Bill Mollison in 1978 wrote Permaculture 1 as part of David's thesis when he was studying at uni. And in 2002, he published a book called Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, and I guess laid the foundations for what I consider to be a lot of contemporary permaculture theory. And there's some really great framing. So there's these 12 principles that are essentially a description of how nature works, I guess, the principles by which natural systems function, and how we can replicate those, mimic those, and integrate those into our lives. And then there is the permaculture flower, which consists of seven petals or seven domains. And it's these domains that we've been looking at. And the domains are really a way of, I guess, thinking more holistically about sustainable culture, maybe more loosely, and I guess resilience more broadly. So instead of just thinking about, you know, people associate, and I know we've talked about this before, but of permaculture as essentially some maybe kind of form of gardening or, you know, around food production.
Yep.
And I understand the origins of that. So in Principles and Pathways, and particularly in the permaculture flower, there's this exploration of, well, what are all the things that we need to consider when we're thinking about households and societies? And so again,
so it's moving, a look at a society-wide problem-solving framework.
So if we still take that loose idea
of problem-solving, that's probably a bit narrow, but yeah, go on.
Well, so the domains in which we need to consider and act and respond. And the domains allow us to think holistically. And so we're not just thinking about gardening in the box, but what are the aspects of tools and technology that we need to think about when we're thinking about growing food, as an example.
Yeah.
What are the aspects of culture and education that are associated with? So, you know, if Whangaroa wants to be more resilient in terms of local food production, so food security, food sovereignty, is we can't just think about food. We also need to be thinking about the culture and education that supports ensuring that you know, those who have expertise are able to share that with others who don't. We need to be thinking about the tools and technologies that support those. We need to be thinking about the finances and the economics.
Yeah.
We need to be thinking about how we manage land and share land and make land available, et cetera, et cetera. So the permaculture flower is basically an exploration of what are all those domains or all those different parts of a system that we need to consider.
Right. And today's domain petal we want to look at is finances and economics.
Yeah.
And that does seem a surprising thing to come out of permaculture.
Hmm.
But I guess David Holmgren got kind of this ambitious look at how far permaculture could reach, I guess. Or.
Yeah, well, and I think to my mind, there's just a recognition that economics is a part of natural systems. It always has been. If we think of economics, if we strip it right back and don't necessarily focus on our current expression of global economics, but as something more simplistically around how the exchange of goods and services are managed, then, you know, we look at ecosystems and we can now see there's definitely an economic activity happening in terms of how certain nutrients are shared and the pathways in which they're shared, how there is no waste and things get circulated through systems, how organisms collaborate to meet mutual needs. And again, that collaboration involves the exchange of different things, whether it's information or micronutrients or whatever it might be. So economics happens. Ecological economics is happening all around us. It's one of the cornerstones, I guess, of living systems, is that there's always exchange and transactions happening.
Yeah. So when we're talking economics, we're not necessarily thinking of it from the perspective of, like, there's an election coming up. We're definitely not talking about it from the perspective that's going to be the election perspective, because that'll be the simplified, dumped-down version that I don't even want to think about. But we're also going much wider than maybe at the moment people will argue about, is neoliberal economics good? Is Keynesianism good? Or is there another way of theorizing about the economy?
Yeah.
are we coming from a different perspective?
Yeah, well, so I guess so that's great. So taking a step back and again reminding us of the permaculture ethics of earth care, people care, fair share or surplus share.
Yeah.
Those three ethics are kind of informing the conversation around finance and economics from a permaculture perspective. And so if we are looking at earth care, then the conversation changes, I would say, quite significantly, quite quickly. If we are talking about people care, again, the frame of our conversation changes. And so, and again, just simplistically said, is right now, as an example, is there's no political party in New Zealand, maybe outside of the Democrats for, oh my gosh, got a mind blank.
The Democrats, you're talking about social credit.
Thank you, Democrats for Social Credit.
Yeah.
Outside of that individual party, you know, who've been around forever but are kind of rebranded and new, is no one is really talking about anything beyond some version of green growth, right? So the assumption is that the economy is the most important thing and humans are subservient to that and nature is subservient to that. So everything's flipped around, I would argue.
Yeah.
Yep. Whereas if we look at finances and economics from as if the environment and people mattered, I think we'd be having very different conversations. And so that's part of what I want to explore today.
Okay. All right. So where do you start with that?
So I guess we've set the framework in terms of if economics is loosely about the agreements and practices about the way goods and services are produced and distributed, then we need to think not just about the market and not just about the state, which is the common way, I guess, of thinking about economics today, but we need to start thinking about the household because that's where most economic activity happens. And historically, that's definitely true. And so the what I'd call the informal economy, so those parts of the economy that haven't been commodified or turned into monetary transactions.
So you talk about the household, you're not talking about when we go down the shop to get some bread.
I'm talking about making the bread at home.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Or maybe growing it in the garden.
Yeah.
Or even swapping stuff with neighbors or anything that...
So there's that element, but it's not even just about replacement or instead of going to the shops to buy stuff, it's even just the stuff that the shops can't offer, like childcare, education.
Yes.
You know, and this isn't always true, but I guess even just the mundane things around cleaning the house and tidying up the garden and those activities that typically sit outside the formal economy, the kind of the cash economy, that's still part of our economic model. There's still trade and exchange that happens.
Well, you can pay to get all those things done.
Yeah.
Most people don't, and therefore it often doesn't get included. Like, it's not included in our GDP, for instance.
Yeah, because GDP doesn't care about those things, right?
Yeah.
It's just about churn. It's about the amount of, quote-unquote,
cash movement.
Monetary. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then we have the other piece that's often ignored too, which is the commons. And I know there's the whole thing around, you know, the tragedy of the commons, but there's some great research to suggest that actually under a series of, I guess, kind of cultural values and practices, the commons has almost always been a source of prosperity and wealth for local communities. And so what are those shared spaces and those shared resources that, again, historically have sat outside of the formal economy. They haven't had a price tag. And, you know, that's still relevant for, I guess, me and my life in terms of where, you know, we're foragers. And, you know, so a portion of the way in which we meet our needs is based on the things that are around us that we don't buy.
So what are the commons? List some things. Name some things that are in the commons.
Yeah, well, so I guess from a traditional perspective, and when I say traditional, I'm really thinking of, in this case, Māori, is I understand the role of, say, like Mahinga Kai, of cultural harvest sites where you had plenty of resources. So whether that was fiber or food or medicine, is these places that were abundant in resources. So they were shared, they weren't necessarily owned in our current sense of ownership. And people would come gather, usually process on site, depending on what it was, and then take what they did back to, you know, wherever they were living. And so they were these places that people came to gather things. So that's, a more historic
example. Yeah, so what's left of that now? I guess the ocean, when you go fishing, is obvious. Only one I can think of.
Yeah, so a lot of our wetlands have been significantly degraded. You know, there are still paharakiki around, but some of them aren't necessarily in public spaces. So again, those you know, what would you call them, fiber gardens of sort.
Yeah.
And I guess to a certain extent you have elements of that with places like Carioi and some of our larger bushes. One could argue that hunting exotic, you know, going into the bush is kind of part of that extended commons,
yeah, yep,
as well. You know, the feral pigs, the goats, etc. So there is still the commons, and like you said, Whangaroa herself, you know, the actual harbor and all the abundance, and then the coastline associated with that. Other examples, I guess, more from more of a European perspective would be those areas that sat on the fringes and outside typically of the township, where you might have shared grazing areas or you might have woodlots that could be, or coppicing forests that people could come and take fiber from and then go back and use it. And so
what about things like I know someone who needed some bamboo at one point and rang a farmer down the road and said, can I come and grab some bamboo from your place? And the farmer's like, please do.
Yeah.
So I think that's still commons.
Exactly. Well, so it's interesting because it's a modern commons, I guess, because it's held in private ownership, but it's made accessible through negotiation.
Yeah.
Yep. And so it is a form of commons. And I definitely tap into those shared resources, I guess. And again, assuming they are shared by the people whose ownership they're under. But I think that's a great example.
Yeah.
And so we need to include those elements, those informal, or when I say informal, because they haven't been they haven't been monetized in the same way. So those are all part of that broader economic model. So from a permaculture lens, if we're thinking about the market and the role that the state plays in the economy, but we're also thinking about the role that the household plays and the role that those shared spaces and communal resources play, we have already our frame or our understanding of finances and economics changes.
Yeah.
And if the purpose of an economy is to support nature to thrive and to support the human communities that live in those or are embedded in those systems to thrive, and we think of ways of ensuring that resources are distributed equitably, and there in that space there is, I guess, a human element in terms of you know, does our economic systems help the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, or do they distribute that across a broader spectrum? So there's those elements. There's the intergenerational element. Are our economic practices impoverishing future generations, or are they ensuring that, you know, we're thinking seven generations ahead, or whatever that future focus is, tukuiho, tikuiho? Are we thinking that long-term in perpetuity health and well-being? And then I would also argue in that fair share element, there's also that more than human world. Are we taking everything for ourselves and therefore reducing the ability of the rest of life to thrive? Or are we actually ensuring that we are an active agent in a thriving ecosystem? And so all of a sudden, the picture that's painted through this lens of economics, I would argue, is very, very different from the one we have today.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. And the assumptions that they force on you are different as well.
Yeah. And you can imagine what we measure as kind of economic wealth in this context is very different, right?
Hard to measure. Harder to measure than in the conventional context where everything is very traceable.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah?
Yeah. So there's some really amazing tools that have been developed.
The tax department would like to talk to you.
Yeah.
Because they want to measure everything.
Well, so there is an element there, I guess, of... Yeah, because this is a fundamentally different system, and what does taxation look like in this kind of system?
Yeah.
But to my mind, so there's a few things there, but there is some great work that's been done over the years developing things like what's called genuine progress indicators, almost as a complement or a supplement is maybe a better word, to GDP.
Yeah.
Kind of going, actually, GDP doesn't actually matter things that... or doesn't measure things that matter, I don't think, anyway. You know, it matters outputs as opposed to quality of life markers.
Well, yeah, if you have a was it Deepwater Horizon, massive oil spill, and the money spent on that.
That's great for GDP.
Yeah, it's great. Totally. Yeah, GDP is agnostic about whether it was good or bad for the environment.
Natural disasters are great for GDP.
Wars,
all that stuff, right? Yeah. And so how do we measure well-being, as an example? So anyway, genuine progress indicators is a tool that's been developed whereby communities can actually start to map out their own indicators. What is success or what is achievement? What is wealth look like for us? And then you can actually measure yourself against those over time. And so we do have, that's the exciting thing for me in this space of, I guess, kind of new economics is an ecological economics. There's a wealth of frameworks and ways of thinking and practical tools that have been developed to empower households, neighborhoods, communities to actually reinvent local economics.
So when David Holmgren produced his book in 2002, did he look around and see, oh, this is happening in the economics and finances realm and kind of pull that in as part of his theory? Or did he create this theory and then other people have gone and built on it? And said, here's according to David Holmgren's theory, I'm now studying this aspect of economics.
Yeah, so I think David is brilliant and I have a lot of respect for him. And at risk of sounding offensive is, I don't think that the people who are developing solutions maybe know anything about David's work. So I think there's an element of a coincidence in some of the things that he's been exploring, others are exploring as well.
I guess that's inevitable though, isn't it? It's a big world. There's several billion people.
That's right.
And we recognize these problems. So,
and I do think there's an element of him looking around and going, oh, well, what's happening out there that kind of fits within a permaculture worldview?
Yeah.
And so things like regional and I guess community-based economic systems, you know, that are coming into place, whether that's through things like regional currencies, you know, yep, which is okay. Becoming more and more common. And there's lots of really good examples around the world of that happening. And through, I guess, another kind of permaculture lens is transition culture, which came out of a permaculturist named Rob Hopkins, based in originally, I guess, in Kinsale, Ireland, but then that moved to Totnes.
Are you familiar with the New Economics Foundation?
I am.
UK? Yeah.
Yep, I am.
Like,
yep.
I used a little bit of, and I don't want to imply that I'm some kind of expert or anything here, but I used a little bit of their research when I looked at extreme zero waste and their economic contribution to the community.
Yeah.
Which was, yeah.
So there's some really great stuff out there. So there's CASE that's out there doing some really great work, and they basically study steady state economics, which is mostly the work of Herman Daly, and others have developed it. There is the New Systems Project, which is an awesome think tank mainly based out of the States, which has kind of gone, well, actually, come on, people, let's own up to the fact that our current economic model is dying and it's just not working. It's actually killing the planet. We need to think beyond it. And they're doing some really interesting work in that space. There's quite a few different organizations. Here in Aotearoa, we have Living Economies Trust, which has done some brilliant work, including things like they have championed really specifically Brian Innes and Joe Pearsall have pioneered savings pools, which is one of the most innovative, I think, economic models that I know of. And again, particularly focused around finances.
I remember when Brian first brought that to Raglan, I was talking to him, where did you get this from? Like,
yeah. And so did he tell the story about Jack's Bank going to Sweden and the eco show?
Oh, yeah. Because so, I was at that first eco show.
So there's the fuck-up there of, you know, taking ideas from overseas, trying them out here and going, that doesn't quite work in our context. Well, what do we need to do to change it and make it work for our for Aotearoa?
And there are a couple of savings pools in Whangaroa.
There's two in Whangaroa. And there's about 40 of them nationally. And they're just brilliant. I think they're amazing. So I set one up in Tamaki when I lived up north, and I've recently joined one of the pools here. So I feel very proud to be involved.
And for people who don't know what that is, I guess the main point of it is you're taking the bank, you're taking the so-called middleman out of the equation, and keeping your money in the community. That's the kind of the primary purpose. That's a really skinny look at it.
It's a little bit different for me, but there is that element.
That's what I remember about it.
Yeah, so for me, I guess it's about having access to finance without needing to pay interest and having...
I need to throw that in there.
And having money... it's about mutual benefit is another part of it too, is so how do how does community support community to be able to access capital without needing interest? And then the brilliant thing about the model is by lending my money to others when I don't need it, even if it's a small or large sum, it doesn't really matter, is that by doing so, at the end of that full transaction, the money that I've lent is now savings for me. And so I get my money back, but it has a it's kind of been enhanced through the process of lending it out. And again, it's a bit of a deep rabbit hole to get into, but as an example, my understanding anyway, and I haven't had these direct conversations, but I have read an article years ago, is that Raglan Food Co. got up and running. The seed money for that was through the original savings pool that was set up. And so, you know, that was a group of people who had enough money to lend to local entrepreneurs who had a great idea and gave them the financial capital to get it up off the ground without having the stress or the overheads associated with taking in a large loan from a bank.
Yeah, and sometimes people wouldn't even be able to take out a loan from a bank.
Yeah,
the bank
that's
would
true
say,
too.
"No, you're too big a risk."
Yeah,
and but it's a complete. Even if I use the word risk now, you need to explain that risk is handled differently. It's not seen as a risk. There is no risk.
Well, in the 42, I think it's the 42 savings pools in Aotearoa today. Not one of them have ever had anyone default on any of their loans.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah, so not
that's
a single.
That's a useful answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So people have renegotiated the terms of what they've borrowed because circumstances change and all the rest of it. But it's just a different way that resource, the financial resource, stays within the community. There's other things around local currencies, I guess, and another example of how redesigning money and economics can have huge benefits for local communities. So with local currencies, I'll start with national currency. What typically happens with national currency is you have about 80% leakage. So say, let's make some assumptions that everyone in Whangaroa gets paid on a Wednesday. And so that money comes in from wherever it comes in. Yeah. And it arrives into the Whangaroa catchment, I guess, as it were, as a community catchment. And then over the course of, say, that month, is by people spending money the way they do, that money kind of leaks out of the local community through things like doing business where goods and services come from outside, or foreign ownership. And when I say foreign, I don't necessarily mean overseas, but ownership models where profits leave the system.
Yeah.
Whereas when you start looking at local currencies, the opposite happens is you have 80% of that wealth is retained in the community because people are using local money to shop locally, invest in local businesses, and you don't have that same wealth leakage.
So Brian Innes, when he first came here proposing the savings pools, showed a graph of money leaving the local community, and it's actually quite frightening.
It's shocking.
A lot of it just comes down to the fact that we're paying interest on loans.
There's more than that, but it is
but,
that. But
yeah,
that happens
yeah, yeah,
collectively,
that's right.
too. It's businesses paying back money that they've borrowed. It's individuals paying back money that they've loaned. But then it's also franchising and a lot of things being... So it is, but it's paying bills, I guess, and paying bills to entities, financial entities or businesses or whatever that aren't based in Whangaroa.
I think another good example, the one I know intimately is because I made this film about extreme zero waste, was the way they spend money, them compared to waste management, doing all our, mm-hmm. our waste management
yep.
in Whangaroa.
Yep.
And if you look at the money that the community gives them in the form of rates, mm-hmm. and we view that as an investment, then the community makes a profit on their investment in extreme zero waste because they actually spend more money into the community than they get paid. Whereas the way, I did an analysis of waste management, or not waste management, but a conventional corporate waste contractor, mm-hmm. and I talked to someone who had worked in the waste industry, and you give them the money, and less money is returned to the community.
Yeah.
Like less than half of it comes back, I think.
Well, and you can imagine in that example, you've got local jobs. You know, I don't know where it's at now, but somewhere around 20 locals are...
20 full-time locals. Yeah. So 40 overall people have work between full-time and part-time workers up there, yeah.
And so there's those elements as well. And then those people spend their money locally, and so the money...
Yeah.
And so you can imagine how you can create this kind of ecosystem of... local enterprise where money just kind of keeps feeding back. One of the best examples I know of this is actually Mullaney in southern Queensland in Australia, where they have a series of cooperatives, and those cooperatives over time have kind of come to fill these niches, and they go, oh, well, what else do we need as a community that we're not currently providing for ourselves? And then a new cooperative has sprung up to meet that need.
So where's Mullaney?
Mullaney is kind of Sunshine Coast, inland from the Sunshine Coast.
Okay.
Up on the, I think it's called the Tablelands, but...
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, not too far, maybe about an hour and a half, 2 hours from Brisbane.
Yeah. It's a short drive by Australian standards.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Hey, look, we've kind of... Well, we have run out of time. I did want to ask one question, which is a lot of economics is about, conventionally, is about taking the small transactions, individual transactions, and then working out how that relates to the big economic system.
So micro-macroeconomics.
Yeah, yeah. And does permaculture get into that? Does permaculture overall talk about systems theory and emergent properties and things like that?
Absolutely. I'd say permaculture is based in kind of an understanding of complex living systems.
Okay.
Yeah. But the I think one of the differentiating things for me about permaculture is it assumes that, like life itself, that things organize from the bottom up. And so it's much more interested in microeconomics and the power to self-organize up as opposed to top-down. Yeah. You know, when you think of... I can't think of any living system that operates from the top down, if that makes sense. You know, it operates from atoms, form molecules, you know, cells form, you know, everything builds up. And so there's very much an understanding of starting from kind of grassroots individuals and households, and then those inform neighborhood and community practices, and then those inform, et cetera. But
every now and again, the economic system, when times are desperate, recognizes that it's from the bottom up. Like when we had COVID, and the government was like, "We got to keep paying people, otherwise the economy will seize up."
The Great Depression,
and the US in 2008, when they had the economic crisis, they were giving everyone thousands of dollars just to spend to keep the economy going. So finally admitting that, it's really how it works. It's the people at the bottom that everything's resting on.
Yeah.
And you can't let them crumble too much.
And so how does that inform our thinking about, future economics in Whangaroa? And you know, in all smaller kind of bioregion and communities is, you know, there's so long as, you know, there's a state, there's always going to be a desire to have policy that regulates and informs how our economy functions. But there's an opportunity for us to organize from the bottom up, again, starting at the personal and household level, but up to the community scale. And there are, you know, and I know we've run out of time, but there's lots of great things happening in Whangaroa that are examples of that kind of regional and that local economics.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's crop swap or tool library, you know, there's any number of things that are about, you know, shared consumption or barter and exchange.
And it's interesting that the Environment Centre is caught up in a lot of those things.
Oh, absolutely.
Or maybe it's not, but maybe it's not surprising given exactly what we're talking about.
I don't think it's caught up at all. I think it's consciously thinking about how do you enable local prosperity.
Yeah, yeah. And we shouldn't be surprised that people focused on the environment are looking at the economic side of things based on our discussion this morning, which is how economics is working within the permaculture framework.
And I appreciate we could talk for hours about this.
Oh, I know we could. Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll do that another time because we're going to keep talking to you about these things. This is our fourth domain we've looked at. So we're going to look at, folks, we're talking to Finn McAsee right now, a permaculturist, and we've been talking about these domains, and we've got podcasts of those, so you can go back and check those out. And so we've got three more to go, and then we'll also just continue to talk every month about whatever we think we need to talk about.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe think we could might go pick up the permaculture principles, maybe.
Yeah, we could obviously go for some years based on how we feel. Like, I feel like we've just scratched the surface on this topic this morning. Yeah, which is kind of the point, I guess. Mm. Yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.